So, my name is Cecil Casucci. These are some of my books. They're a little cut off on the top. Who cares? I write mostly young adult novels, but I also write comic books. I write performance art pieces. I do. I write librettos for operas. Basically, I've dedicated my entire life to writing stories. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about some of my books, and then I'm going to talk about, sort of my journey to how I became a storyteller. And then I'm going to talk about Tin Star. I'm actually going to grab Tin Star and Stone in the Sky, which are my newest books. It's a two-book sci-fi series. And then sort of what the inspirations were for that, and then I'm going to talk about my writing process. So it's kind of like an overview of everything. So Boyproof was my first novel. Boyproof is about a girl who is obsessed with post-apocalyptic science fiction films and dresses up as the main character of her favorite films to go to school every day. So imagine that you came to school every day dressed as a Tusken Raider, or, or Princess Leia, or, Gamora, or whatever. So she pretty much hates everyone, and then one day a boy who draws comic books sits next to her in English class, and her whole life changes. First Day on Earth is about a boy who believes that he's been abducted by aliens, so he starts going to an alien abduction support group, and when he's there, he thinks that there's a guy who's either a crazy homeless person or an alien, and they go on a road trip to meet the spaceship, because obviously that's what you do when you meet an alien, you try to go to ride on their spaceship, right? I was saying yesterday that one thing I try to do with every book that I write is I try to sort of give myself a little narrative challenge. And with First Day on Earth, I'm a pretty lean writer. I'm very, action and dialogue oriented. I don't describe grass for, 10 pages. So one of the challenges that I had with First Day on Earth is I wanted to see if I could write a book where the reader could decide who was lying and who was telling the truth and that both answers would be correct. And how economical, how much could I distill a book to its essence, to its story essence? So some chapters in First Day on Earth are one page long. Some chapters in First Day on Earth are one sentence long. So it's really, it's just like a quick clip. Year of the Beasts is a hybrid novel. So it's alternating chapters of prose and graphic novel. Or comic book. So the prose part, the words, is about two sisters and the boys they like and the summer. And the graphic novel is about a girl who's a Medusa and her friends have turned into mythological creatures and she doesn't know why she's like that. One of the things I love about writing comic books is that, you know that old saying, a picture tells a thousand words, right? Well, you know when you're feeling very happy or sad or angry and you're like, I'm so angry! I'm really angry, and it doesn't really actually express how you're really feeling. It's like the words are almost clumsy. What I love about writing comics is that the images and the sort of sequential way that you can tell stories or the pause with silent panels really gives you that. Like, have you ever looked at a picture in a comic book and you're like, oh, that's exactly it, and there's no words in there? That's what I love about comics. And so with this book, I wanted to talk about sort of enormous feelings. And when I ran out of words, have the images sort of tell the story for me. So you can actually read this book, just the prose and you get a story, or just the comics and you get a story. But if you read the whole book together, you get the story. So that was the challenge over there. The Plain Janes is it's a two-book series on DC Comics. It's about an all-girl guerrilla art gang, and they go around doing art attacks, and the town doesn't like that, and so they have to sort of fight for the right to make art. Beige is about a girl who hates music, and her father is the most infamous drummer in a punk rock band that never made it out of Los Angeles because of, drugs and decadence. And now he's clean and sober, and Katie is forced to live with him in Los Angeles. And I wanted to talk about, I used to be in a band, and what I was really interested in was how, you hear a song, and it's like, or you hear that saying, rock and roll can save your life, but I wanted to talk about the absence of music, too, and how that can sort of, affect your life in ways as well. And punk rock is a very sort of mysterious scene. You know, some people think, it's just loud music and mohawks or whatever, but it's not. It's really a sort of frame of mind. And so I wanted to talk about punk rock, but instead of somebody being in the scene, I wanted to talk about sort of observing the scene. And I got the idea for that book because when I first moved to Los Angeles, I was at a Thanksgiving dinner, and I was sitting next to this guy. I had no money. I moved there with $100 and you know, my first month's rent, and which was, by the way, a dumb idea. And I got there, and I was at this dinner table. It's Thanksgiving dinner, and this guy was sitting next to me, and he lived like a block away from me. And it turned out he was Tim Armstrong, who's the lead singer of Rancid. And so he got me a job at this record company called Epitaph Records, which, you know, do a lot of punk rock. You know, they're a punk rock label, so they do a lot of famous punk rock albums. And so he said, oh, I'll get you a job. And so he got me a job at Epitaph Records. And I was in a band. I was in an indie rock band, you know. But indie rock is a little bit different than punk rock. And so I walked into this scene, and I was like, whoa, it's so different. And I was trying to figure out my way in. And so that's where I got the idea for that. The Queen of Cool is sort of my anti-Gossip Girl book. It's about a mean girl who gets a science internship at the Los Angeles Zoo. And she has a panic attack. So she joins the Los Angeles Zoo, and she thinks she's going to be the coolest person there. But as she's shoveling sort of elephant poop, she realizes very quickly that she's not very cool. And she's paired with a little person who has achondroplasia, or dwarfism, and a guy who wants to be an astrobiologist, and which is the study of alien life. And she realizes pretty quickly what's cool, really, for reals. Odd Duck is a book about two ducks who are odd, and they both think that they're totally normal and that their friend is the weirdo, and that doesn't work out so well for them because they're both weird. And then Rosie's Red, which is the book in the middle, it is about it's the politics of friendship juxtaposed with the politics of the Cold War. So it's two ballet dancers in 1982 New York City. Geektastic is an anthology that I co-edited with an author named Holly Black. And it's about short stories about geeks and the Geek Observed, because I'm a huge geek. And so it's got people like Cassandra Clare, Kelly Link, N.T. Anderson, John Green, Sarah Zarr, a whole bunch of really great people. And interstitially, inside, there are single-page comics illustrated by Hope Larson and Brian Lee O'Malley. So once again, like, I'm really interested in like sort of high, like doing comics in any way I can. Tin Star and Stone in the Sky, I'll talk a little bit about them later, but it's a duet sci-fi novel. Okay, so then it just got announced the other day, Tusken Raider, you may be interested, that I'm writing a Princess Leia adventure in advance of The Force Awakens. So I'm pretty excited about it. It's going to be... So that's my new book. It's coming out in September 4th. So I'm going to talk a little bit about growing up, and we'll go right back to Star Wars, because that was the moment where I knew that I wanted to be a writer. When I saw Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, my mind exploded. And I'm not going to spoil it for you guys, right? You've all seen it? You've seen it? Okay. Sorry, you're in it, so it's a little, you know. So at the end of Episode 4, when the Death Star blows up, my God... Darth Vader goes spinning off, you know, and it was the first time that I realized that stories could be continued and that it was someone's job to write that story. And I was like, ah, me! You know, so I, of course, quickly, at 7 years old, wrote my version of what was happening next with a fabulous princess named Cecil. And sadly, they didn't go for that version, but, you know, I guess I'm going to get one in there eventually, Princess Cecil. So then, but I thought, oh, this is really sad.
What's the keystone, actually?
What's the keystone?
There's a little switch. There's a button called keystone.
So sad, my head is cut off. Keystone? No? Yeah? No? No. I don't know why it's a... Anyway, just imagine that my head is there. So I was a little ballerina, and so that was the first thing. That was my first sort of introduction to art. So I'd seen Star Wars, and then I was a ballerina. I actually started dancing when I was 4 years old. And what I loved most about dance was stories. And one thing that I don't have a dancer's body. I'm very small, very curvy. I was never going to be a ballet dancer. I mean, I guess I could have been like a modern dancer, a performance artist or something, but I was obsessed with ballet. And towards the end of my dancing career, when I was 12, I realized that I really wanted to... I liked most when I would sit and I would watch the other dancers dancing, and I would create stories. So it was like I was already creating stories. But just about that same time, my brother was dancing with a ballet dancer named Jacques Dambois. Jacques would go into schools, public schools, and teach boys how to dance, and so that they didn't think it was just for girls. And so this is Jacques dancing with some boys. Oh, he's got a head. He would dance with a bunch of boys, but one day we were all and on Saturday afternoons, he wouldn't let any kids that were in the room sit down. All kids had to dance. So I would dance with these kids on Saturday afternoons, and one day we were out to lunch, and he looked at me, and he was like, I think maybe you're an artist of some kind. And so these early mentors are really important in your life as an artist, because you get so many no's all the time and so many like, oh, you don't have a dancer's body, or you can't do this, or you're not special enough for this, or, you know, just don't even bother trying to be an artist. I had one art teacher just say to me, like, promise me you'll never be a visual artist, you know? And I was like, okay. But then I was like, dude, whatever, conceptual art, I can do whatever, it doesn't matter. So people are always saying no. So when you have these mentors who say, you know, something, I don't know what it is, you can do it. So this was another mentor of mine. This was my favorite English teacher named Miss Kay. Now, Miss Kay, she ran the literary journal in my school, which I never got a short story in, and she also ran the special creative writing class where you had to, like, audition to get in. You had to, like, write a short story, and then they would accept you if you had exceptional talent, you know? I did not get into that at all. But she was fantastic, and she was like, this isn't really for you, this class, this formal, like, creative writing class. So we had to do a report on, or an essay, write an essay about the Cold War. We were, like, studying the Cold War and, you know, and whatever. And so she said to me, I said to her, I said, I don't want to write an essay. Essays are not my thing, you know. So I said, can I do a performance art piece instead of an essay, you know. So she said, okay, you know. And I came into school, I prepared my performance art piece. I was a nuclear bomb, and, you know, like, I did the whole, you know, dance in front of the class and whatever. It was pretty much the worst performance art piece you've ever seen. And but she saw that I was different, and she saw that something inside of me that I, you know, that she wanted to nurture. And it wasn't going to be in what... So sometimes when people say no, they're really saying yes to sort of a different part of you. And so I was friends with her up until she died. And Jacques, who's now 84, and still has that dance thing where he goes to schools in New York City, he's still my friend. Like, I just had coffee with him in October. So I got to college. I thought I was going to be a filmmaker. And so, of course, when you go to film school, you join a band, right? So that's what I did. I joined a band. The first one was called Bite. The second one was called Nerdy Girl. And then I went by my punk name, Cecil Seaskull, because, of course, you have a punk name. I was doing music. Now, one thing about doing music, indie rock music, it was I was doing this during the sort of heyday of the Riot Grrrl scene in Montreal. But the Riot Grrrl scene wasn't really in Canada, but there weren't a lot of all-girl bands in Canada at the time. There were girls that sang and stuff like that, but there weren't a lot. There was Jail in Halifax, Cub in Vancouver, and Bite in Montreal. And so the thing that I loved about being in this band was that we didn't know how to sing. We didn't know how to play instruments. Our first jam ended because we didn't even have a drum kit. We had a soup pot and a plastic ladle, and it exploded, and that was, well, I guess the jam is done, you know. We wrote songs like Ew, I Kissed Him, and, you know, I was obsessed with Boris Becker, the tennis player, so I wrote a song about him. And it was just good fun, and it was because the boys didn't want us to be in their bands because we didn't know how to play, and we just thought, who cares, we're going to play anyway. So that was a really instrumental and influential thing in my sort of creative life, because it made me, like, when people said, well, you don't know how to do that, you know, well, everybody doesn't know how to do something before they've done it. So I was like, well, whatever, we had a soup pot and a ladle, and we made punk rock, so why not, you know, I can do anything, you know? And it went pretty successful. I mean, we, with Nerdy Girl, with Bite, we put out some 7-inches, and with Nerdy Girl, I put out 2 CDs, and, a couple of 7-inches, toured Canada and the States, like, 7 times, so you know, it worked out really well. So music is a really big part of my process and my writing. Now I don't do punk rock anymore. I'm so sad about this cutoff. But anyway, I don't do music anymore, but I got approached by a Montreal company called Ensemble Contemporain de Montréal, and they asked me if I wanted to be paired up with a composer and to come up with a project. And I said, sure, can I do a comic book opera? So I did a comic book opera called Les Aventures de Madame Merveille. I had drawings done by Scott Hepburn, Michael Cho, Pascal Girard, and Cameron Stewart. And, you know, we projected it onto the stage. The singers were sort of interacting with the pictures and stuff like that. But once again, it's marrying my idea of, like, stories and how can I tell them and how, what are the different ways, different mediums that you can use things, you know, using, making a hybrid novel, making a hybrid opera, you know, always interested in stories. Because I got kind of jealous of visual artists who, you know, when a visual artist, Scott, maybe you do this, right? You go to a picnic, and you could bring your little sketch pad, and you can bring a pencil, or crayons, or watercolors, or I don't know what the tools are. Yeah, pastels, right? The tool that you use changes the sort of narrative of that picture, what the picture is sort of telling it, the feeling that that picture tells. And I kind of feel like stories do that too. Like a song is a story, and it tells it evokes a different kind of emotion than a comic book does, or a performance art piece, or a poem, or a comic book opera, or an opera, or, you know, so a novel. And so I sort of decided that I just wanted to dedicate my life to telling stories, and so oftentimes what I do is I sort of let the story tell me how it wants to be told. So I'm going to get to Tin Star. Tin Star is my newest book, my newest series, and it's about a human girl named Tula Bain who's abandoned on an alien space station at the brink of a galactic war. She's the only human. Humans are hated in the galaxy, and she has to basically behave like an alien in order to survive. I mean, she's got a choice. She can die, or she can try to survive. And then, as a result of this war, some humans crash land onto the space station, and she doesn't know sort of how to be human anymore. And so she has to sort of refigure that out. So I just really wanted to tell a story. You know how there are a lot of stories about, like, Katniss. I love Katniss, but she's so, like, she can do anything, you know? And I wanted to, like, tell, I mean, if I were abandoned on an alien space station, I would not fare so well, you know? Except for maybe if I made friends with some aliens. But how do I get my ideas? That's a question I get a lot. So for this book, I got the idea while I was watching a film called Casablanca. Have you guys seen the movie Casablanca or heard of it? It's an old movie, came out in 1943, stars Humphrey Bogart, who's amazing. And I was having one of those nights that you have when you're an artist or a human of any kind, where everything sucks and the only thing that will help you is, like, ice cream and an old movie. And so I was, like, eating my ice cream, probably had a glass of wine, like, you know, maybe crying, like, watching Casablanca. And as I was watching this movie, as these things do, they make you feel better. And when you feel better, you start thinking. And this is just to prove to you that you never know where you're going to get an idea for a book. So here I am, watching this movie, and I'm thinking about how Casablanca in this movie is this place. So it's the story of this guy, this American guy named Rick. He's an American guy. He's got a cafe in Casablanca. His heart was betrayed in Paris by this woman, that woman. And she shows up in his cafe. And you might have heard that saying where it's like, you know, of all the gin joints in all the world, why'd she have to walk into mine, you know? And it's during World War II. So everyone's fleeing Nazi Germany. And they're coming to Casablanca, and they're trying to get exit visas to get out. But the thing is that it doesn't matter if you were rich where you came from or if you were poor. It's just how you negotiate and try to do the deals in order to get these passes. And I just was thinking, as I was watching this, like, well, what if that were in outer space? Because Casablanca, it felt like a contained sort of claustrophobic place that everybody was, like, getting into. And then I was like, what if Rick were a 16-year-old girl instead of an old grizzled American guy, you know? And what if everyone was an alien? And what if, you know, you just start playing like that, and then all of a sudden, boom, you've got, you know. So if you read Tin Star and you've seen Casablanca, you'll see echoes of the movie in there, but it's completely different and cracked, and, you know, it's just the seed. But you never know where the seed is going to come from. Another thing I was really interested in was, you know, when I'm creating a world that I've created for my own mind, it's hard to figure out, like, what are your galactic politics, you know? If you look to any science fiction or fantasy world, usually there's one moment in history that the author has sort of zoomed in on and used that as a base for their galactic politics or fantastical politics, whatever it is. So for me, it was really this idea of the occupied zone. So I was really interested in the idea that there's this occupied zone, so I have an Imperium, and then a free zone, where, you know, people are sort of allowed to do what they want. So this was called Vichy France. Now, they were really a puppet government of the Nazis. They weren't really free. They were collaborating with the Nazis. And in the movie Casablanca, if you've seen it or if you are going to see it, there's a constable, and he works for the Vichy. But his morals, what he decides is okay and not okay, is very, very, he plays fast and loose with it. And he really sort of comes up with what his own code of conduct is. And I was really interested in that sort of tension. Like, what do you do when the law is given to you as one way, but you disagree with it, but you have to uphold that law, but you have your own moral conduct? So there's a constable in Tin Star, and that kind of deals with that. The next thing is that, I don't know about you guys, but when I love a fantastical world, I want to eat it, I want to sleep with it, I want to, you know, cuddle up with it, I want to spoon with it, I just love it so much. I want to play it, I want to do everything with it. So I used to play Dungeons and Dragons, actually I still play Dungeons and Dragons, I play every month with my friends. So I play Dungeons and Dragons, and I play role-playing games my entire life, and I know that this is King Kong, and so a lot of people here are gamers. And I have a friend who has a publishing company called Green Ronin. And Green Ronin, they do games like, they do the DC Comics role-playing game, they do the Game of Thrones role-playing game, they do the Dragon Age role-playing game. And so I was having dinner with him, because I was up in Seattle at Geek Girl Con, and I said, wait, could I make a game of my book? And he was like, sure. And he has an open license system called the True 20 system. So I made a role-playing game for the novel Tin Star and Stone in the Sky. So basically you play some aliens who go to the space station, and you're Tina Faray, and you interact with the main character. It's a mini-adventure. You can play it in one night or two nights. And because it was just fun. And like I was saying before, I think a story tells you how it wants to be written, but sometimes you're not ready to let go of that story. You know, I still wanted to be in that world. So I wrote a game. So I'm going to get to my writing. One thing that I do, my process for writing, is for every single novel, I make a playlist. So it's cut off a little bit, but I think you can see what some of the names are of the songs. But why do I make a playlist for each of my novels? Well, writing is really hard, and it's super annoying, and it's hard to get your bum in the seat and just actually sit there and type. So I always make a playlist, and I don't even necessarily like the song that's on the playlist, but they're songs that, for whatever reason, automatically make me feel like I'm in the world that I'm writing. And that, putting that playlist on, means that no matter what, if I'm in a bad mood, if I don't want to write, if I don't feel it, if the muse hasn't struck me, I can automatically get into the mood of whatever book I'm writing. So for Year of the Beast, it was kind of like a sort of dreamy, sort of sad music because you know, there's a little bit of strangeness going on in that book. For one of my books, for the punk rock one, Beige, I listened to a lot of punk rock. What I did was I asked all of my friends, you know, who are musicians, some who aren't musicians, some who are artists, and I asked them, well, what are your top 10 punk rock songs if you were going to give someone a punk rock primer? And then I listened to all those, and what I did was I decided to use them as the chapter headings for the novel in Beige. So when you read Beige, if you don't know a lot about punk rock, you can just download some of those songs and get into it. So the other thing that I'm going to talk about is when I write a novel, What I do is I get a lot of ideas. The postman and the snow, and it's hard. An idea that's never going to be a novel. You know, it's just not going to fly. But sometimes I get kind of like Athena bursting from Zeus's head. I'll get a flash of the beginning and ending of a book, of a story. And I usually write those things down. And then what I do is I build a skeleton. And so I'll just write the parts that I like. And usually that document will be like 50 pages. And then I'll put placeholders in there. Like, something happens with the dad. A battle scene. You know, like, I don't know, whatever it is. And then I have a framework. And once I have that skinny skeleton, then what I do is I can talk about the book because it's like a real book. Because I don't know about you guys, but when I'm writing, when I'm facing that blank page, it's like the worst thing in the world. So if I have something, even if it's all the wrong words, at least I have something to work with and to reject. You know, I can be like, well, that's completely wrong. I can get rid of that. Revising for me is a lot easier than writing a first draft. And all of writing is really revising, just revision, like rewriting. I mean, for every single book that I've ever written, I think I have something like 55 to 60 drafts, you know, it's ridiculous. So then what I do is once I have this framework, I fatten up the baby. So then I start adding all the scenes, you know, and I don't believe in writer's block. I believe that writer's block just means that you've made a wrong turn in the story. And so so usually what I do is I have to go back and see like where I zigged instead of zagged. And oftentimes you can't like figure it out right away. So usually what I do is I'll do the dishes or I'll wash my hair because there's something or take a walk or, you know, but usually when I'm doing the dishes or washing my hair, you're like, oh, I'm doing the dishes and I hate my book and I hate everything. It's the worst and whatever. And then, but your mind, because you're doing this activity, your mind starts sort of going to that dreamy place and really write, you're always working when you're writing. I mean, writing is not like you don't clock in and clock out. It's like you're always working. So, but I wanted to talk about writing comics. So comics, you know, one of the things about, this is from Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics, and one of the first things that that I do when I'm coming up with a comic is I sort of try to figure out what is the style of art that I want in it. Like, do you want something that's like photorealistic, or do you want something that's like, you know, just sort of a suggestion? And that sort of helps, like, helps to sort of focus the story as well. For me, once I see the character design, I know what they can say and what they can't say. So I really, it's a really a collaboration with me and the artist. The other thing is that, like, in comics, as you all know, most of the story happens between the panels, you know? So, like, here, you know that a lot of time has gone by because then there's a sunset. Or here, you know that there's only 1 second has gone by because of that. So that's also, like, when you're writing comics, and, you know, you have to make sure that the story is moving forward, but you can let a lot of the story sort of hang in this sort of interstitial space. So here's a little example. Once again, I'm sorry my Janes don't have heads, but so this is from The Plain Janes, which is a novel that I wrote, which is about an all-girl guerrilla art gang. And right before this, they're at a tree, and there's all these bottles that have instructions for life. So she says, you know, which is cut off, but instructions for life, you know, do things to play and have a fun life. And so he says, sing. He warns them about a police car. And then what's he doing? He's singing, right? But she's singing too. So now my hope is that what you understand is that maybe they have a little crush on each other, you know, but I don't have to tell you, like, they're connected in some way. Like, she starts the song, he starts the song, she finishes the song. And that's what I love about comics, is that you can sort of trust the reader to understand how the story is moving forward. So just to talk about how I work with an illustrator. This is Pickpott and Cullen, which is going to be in the new Comic Squad anthology called Lunch. And this is with Sarah Baron, who did Odd Duck with me. And Pickpott and Cullen, we came up with these characters, and you know, and we did a lot of back and forth. Sarah and I do a lot of back and forth. And one thing is that she will send me, we'll talk about the story, I'll send her some words, and then she'll send me a pencil with her letters. And, you know, we'll talk about whether or not, you know, it's working, you know, What do we need? Do we need another caption? I might tell her, you know what, I think for this one, what we did was that she originally just had Pigputt and Cullen, you know, in the schoolyard with the ball, but she didn't have the other mice. And so I said, hey, you know what, I think we need the other mice in there, and maybe like a little tag that says, oh my God, they're losers. You know, like so that we can kind of understand what Pigputt and Cullen's status is in this school. When I'm writing, I either do something called open script or full script. An open script is where I give the artist a script that has sort of a more open feeling. I don't say page one, panel one, here's what's going to be in panel one, here's what's going to be in panel two, here's what's going to be in panel three. I kind of leave it open. So this is part of my script for Nate Powell, who's the illustrator of Year of the Beasts. He's well known for Swallow Me Whole, and also he's doing the March series with Congressman Lewis about the March on Selma right now. And so this is the script I gave him. And so it just gives the emotional temperature, the sort of basic actions of what's going on, and then he broke down the script. So then he breaks it down. Once again, we have a little conversation. Is this working? Is this not working? Do we need to throw a page out? Oh, I've written too many words, because sometimes what happens is that when I'm writing a comic, I write the script, I overwrite my sort of captions and dialogue, but then once you see the images, the thumbnails, you're like, yeah, we don't need any of those words because everything is already in the image. So so he does that, and then he inks and finalizes the letter. So just so you can see, I think it looks so cool, hey? Don't you think that looks cool? Look at that, amazing. Okay, so then this is another example of open script. This is with Sarah for Odd Duck. So every morning, Chad would wave to Theodora as she did her exercises and he did his. He would listen to loud music and sing, or was it screaming, at the top of his lungs, out of tune on the porch. This is accompanied by violent dancing and wing flapping that made Chad's brightly colored feathers fly everywhere. Theodora decided to keep to herself. Chad was not her style of duck. He was too enthusiastic. So I gave that. That's what I gave to Sarah. And we knew that we wanted Odd Duck to be a sort of a comic book for kids who are just learning how to read. And so this is what she came up with. So as you can see, there's a text on the top, but he's singing off key, out of tune, waving hello, violent dancing, what is going on here? Still, every morning Chad would wave to Theodora as he did his exercise. Chad was not her style of duck. So everything that I wrote in that script, she put on the page. Everything is there. But it's in a different way than if I'd said to her, panel one, he's dancing. Panel two, he's waving. I just did a Wonder Woman comic book. When I do a Wonder Woman comic book for DC, it was a single issue, I do what's called a full script, which means as the writer, you're kind of art directing the whole shebang. So here you've got, page one, panel one. We're in a typical Metropolis hipster cafe. Wonder Woman and Lois Lane are sitting at a table. Lois Lane has her reporter stuff on the table, smartphone that she's using as a voice recorder. Maybe she's got a finger on the button indicating that she's pressing record. Her smart tablet or notebook has questions on it for Wonder Woman that we can read. Lois looks hip and pulled together, not like a Brooklyn hipster. If we see anyone else, it is a guy with chunky glasses and a beard. Taking a picture of them. We are on a two-shot of these formidable ladies. We should see how strong and commandeering Wonder Woman is, sitting in her chair, Lois Lane, tough but softer, flowy curves. One thing we can see on their face and attitudes, things are not going very well. So that's the setup that I gave to my artist. Then I gave the dialogue, right? I don't usually do interviews, Miss Lane. I don't usually do puff pieces. And then her caption, I face gods in battle. This is a close-up of Wonder Woman. She looks pissed off. I'm not a puff piece. Yet somehow this seems harder. Lois Lane, I'm not one for small talk, let's just get to it, right? So then I send that to the artist, and then he draws me the pencil, and it's exactly what I said. Panel one, we have two shot of these ladies. Clearly, he decided to not have a chunky hipster in the background taking pictures. That's fine, I don't care. Usually what I do is I write a little note to the artist saying, like, or whatever you think is best, because sometimes when you're doing a full script, the artist might be like, it'd be cool if we had an insert here. It'd be cool if we had a silent panel. So then, you know, he does this, so that's the pencil. Then it gets colored, right? So now we've got color. So you can see they added in some sort of questions and a little voice recorder and so that we know that, like, you know, she's recording the conversation, right? And then, last but not least, it gets lettered. And so then they put in the lettering, and stuff like that. And so basically, those are the ways that that a comic book is put together. And I really like to collaborate. So for me, even if I'm doing full script with someone, what I like to do with full script is always be talking and in conversation with the artist, so that the artist doesn't feel like, I think I know best, because the artist actually knows best. The artist is the person who is putting it on the page and who has been practicing telling stories sequentially. And so as a writer, it's my job or your job in the empirical you that it's your job to work with the artist to really make it a collaborative thing. And I think one of the reasons why I like collaborating so much with comic book artists or with like a composer when I'm doing my opera is that I get to be a goddess already when I'm writing my novels. I get to decide everything. Nobody interferes with my work, you know? So then it allows me to sort of let things go when I'm working with another artist. And I really find that collaboration is like the fun, cool part of being an artist. So that's pretty much what I've got to say, but I thought maybe we could open it up for questions in case you've got some questions about, process and books and all of that stuff. Any questions?
Out of curiosity, who was the artist on that Wonder Woman
stuff? It was Chris Sprouse.
Okay.
Chris Sprouse is known for Tom Tomorrow, and I think he's doing one of the Convergence things with DC right now. I think he's writing drawing a Grant Morrison book. Yes?
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah. So Odd Duck, so basically to sum up the story of Odd Duck is about a duck named Theodora, and we'll go back so that you can see how fabulous Theodora is. So it's about Theodora, who is a duck who lives in a pond, and she is, she's by herself at the pond, she likes to be alone. And then one day this crazy duck, Chad, moves next to her, door to her, and she's like, I'm not going to be that dude's friend. But then she doesn't go south for winter because she knows how to fly, but she doesn't like to fly. And so he breaks his wing, and he stays home for winter, and they become best friends. But then one day they're in town, and they overhear these two ducks saying, oh my gosh, look at that odd duck. And they both feel super sorry for their friend, because they're like, well, it's kind of true. You know, you are kind of weird, so, you know, don't listen to what they're saying. What? They're not talking about me. They're talking about you. You don't even fly south for winter, and, you know, walk around with a teacup on your head. And she's like, well, you dance like a crazy person. And, you know, so they get really mad at each other. And then they both kind of realize that maybe they are really weird. And so they realize that maybe it's okay to be weird if you have a weird friend. So one day I was at ALA, which is a big conference of authors and writers and librarians. And it was in Washington, D.C. And we were sitting around and somebody was talking about another author. I was at a dinner, an author dinner. And somebody was talking about another author. And they were like, wow, that guy's totally weird, you know? Like, and then someone said, yeah, but, you know, he's our odd duck, you know? And I was looking around at this table, and I was like, well, that person's weird, that person's weird, that person's weird, I'm weird, and that person's weird. And I just thought, like, isn't it so funny how we all think we're perfectly normal and how everyone else is totally strange? And so that's where I got the idea from. Like, I thought, like, and then I just had this idea of Theodora, and I said, so then someone turned to me, actually this writer named, this writer-illustrator, this guy named Peter Reynolds, who wrote this book called The Dot, which I just love, and it's for little kids. And he said, you should write a book called Odd Duck. And I was like, yes, and her name will be Theodora, and she will swim with a teacup on her head, you know? And then it was just like, boom. Like I said, when I get an idea, it just completely, you know, comes out like fully formed almost. Even though I always know where I'm ending and where I start, but I don't know how they get there, you know? So that was how I got the idea for that story. I just thought, you know, everybody's a weirdo, and we should just all accept that we're weird, you know. And everybody, you are odd, and your friend is odd, and it's okay. We're all odd. So, other questions? I know you've got some.
Can you tell us anything about the Star Wars book?
I cannot say anything about the Star Wars book. I know. I can tell you that it's about Princess Leia. And I can tell you that it's coming out in September.
Okay.
And I can tell you that it is going to, I think they said this in the paper, it will have some hints of the new movies. So it'll be some clues. So it's pretty exciting. Because as you saw, like, that's the reason why I became an author. So it's pretty exciting.
You live in L.A. Would you think about coming back to Canada? Like, what's the pros and cons?
Well, there's a lot of sunlight and a lot of warmth in L.A. So sometimes I come back. Like, sometimes, like, when I come to Montreal and Toronto, like, in the spring and summer, I'm like, this place is great. It's amazing here. And then I come back in winter. Like, I was here in January. It was, like, minus 26. And I was like, this is obscene. Why do we live here? Like, this is crazy. So, I do want to come back to Canada at some point. Like, the goal at some point is to sort of be more sort of half and half, because I love Canada, and I, you know, my parents are here, my family's here, my, you know, a lot of my besties are here and stuff. So trying to sort of work that out, but, you know, I got to get the do-re-mi to do that, so buy some books or something. Other questions? Oh, I know you've got some more questions.
When you were a teenager, mm-hmm. I've seen your first picture, I love that picture.
Thanks.
So, and even before that, when you were in your room, do you think you were going to do something in writing or comics or something of the kind? You had that feeling deep in you? Somehow was your dream of somehow?
Yeah, I did. I can't believe Darth Vader's here. When I saw Star Wars, I knew that it was someone, it was the first time it was sort of articulated that it was someone's job. But before then, my parents are both scientists, and my brother grew up to be a scientific journalist. And my mom, when I was like 4, she used to do this thing where she would play, she had a book, and it was for a book for children's games, and it was called Let's Play Math. And I never wanted to play math. I was like, I do not want to play math. I want to choreograph a ballet for you. Or what I used to do is, instead of playing kickball, all the kids in the neighborhood would try to play kickball. But I had seen La Traviata, the opera, and I was like, this is amazing! We should play opera! You know, and none of the kids wanted to play opera with me. And I think at some point my parents kind of realized, like, this girl is not going to be a scientist. It's just not, probably not going to be for her. And so they kind of, you know, they kind of stepped back and sort of let me, you know, and I just, every single thing that I read about artists, every time I heard about dancers or visual artists or anything like that, and it would be like, I don't know, like Buñuel and Salvador Dali hanging out in Paris together, making strange movies. And I was like, that sounds cool. Like, everything about the artist's life just seemed cool. I mean, except for the poverty part, you know, poor Van Gogh, you know, like that. It's pretty terrible. But it just seemed to me like, if what it meant to be an artist was to wake up and tell stories every day, which I love, and do creative collaborative projects with other people who are trying to do extraordinary things to try to figure out what it means to be human, I was, like, signed up. And I do kind of feel like it's almost a calling, you know? Like, you know, I was saying to Scott earlier, who's going to talk next, and I was saying, we met this visual artist at the hotel we were at, and I said, you know, a lot of times kids ask me, well, how do you know? How do you know if you're really a writer? How do you know if you're... I say, try quitting. I quit all the time. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. It's too hard. It's not for the faint of heart. I'm hungry. Like, you know, whatever. It's terrible. But, you know, every day I keep going back. One day, this was like a year and a half ago, I had gotten... I live in Southern California, so you get a discount year-long ticket for Disneyland. It's like $269, and they have blackout dates, but you can go, you know, every day. So I had to go to Disneyland twice in 2 weeks, so it was cheaper for me to buy this year-long pass. So one day, I woke up, I was so frustrated, I was writing Stone in the Sky, I was so frustrated, I couldn't solve the problem at all. I woke up, I was like, I quit. You know what? I quit. Get best day to go to Disneyland, because I'm no longer an author. So I got on a train, went down to Anaheim, went to Disneyland, was in Disneyland, and my agent called me and was like, oh, how's it going? I was like, I quit. I quit being a writer. I'm done. I'm at Disneyland. I've taken a vacation. I'm like, he was like, and he laughed at me, and he was like, okay, call me tomorrow when you're back to work. And I was like, no, it's this time, it's for sure. I'm really done. We're going to give them back the money that I don't have, you know? And you know, of course, the next day, I was back at work and, you know, back writing. So I think I just always knew that it was something that I wanted to do. And I was lucky because I had my parents who were encouraging of that when they saw it, even though it was very different from what they were doing. And I also had Miss Kay and Jacques who were like, I think maybe you're an artist. I don't know what kind of artist you are, but you're something. And that was very, you know, that was lucky. That was really lucky.
Thank you.
Any other last questions?